It's episode 34 of the Planet LP podcast. This is the place where we drop the needle on a world of albums. Hello to you. I'm Ted Asfergadu, and along with me is my fellow Planet LP-er, John Young. Hello, John.
Hello, Ted. Easy on the switches there, my friend. Things could get very sticky during this episode.
Yeah, that's a good teaser. I think so. For those of you new to the podcast, a quick introduction to who we are. John works for Alpha Media, hosting the 95.3 KUIC Morning Show in Vacaville, California. I'm in the news and traffic business. I work for iHeartMedia in San Francisco. Those are our day jobs that we do so well, but we're also huge music fans, like I'm guessing most of you are. We created this podcast to talk about our shared passion for music, connect with fellow music lovers, and sometimes talk to bands we love, like we will be in this episode. If you caught my drift, or at least my friend's drift, John's little teaser there, connect with us on our social channels, Twitter and Instagram. It's the same handle. We're at The Planet LP. Facebook, it's Planet LP. You can always leave us a comment on our website, and some of you have, and we really appreciate it. And I do my best to get back to you, or at least reply to you. It's planetlp.com, where you can leave those comments. If you like email, we have an email account set up for each of us. I'm at ted@planetlp.com, and John is at john@planetlp.com. All of it very easy for you. I teased that we're going to talk to a band we love, and we are. Two members of the LA rock band Dirty Honey will be here to chat with us. We're both super excited to speak with guitarist John Notto and bassist Justin Smolian from the group. Stick around. At the end, we have an announcement about an extra that you're going to want to check out after the episode. All righty, John, let's get it started. Dirty Honey's home base is in Los Angeles, and their beginnings start in 2017 when one of our guests, John Notto, came to LA from the East Coast to start a band and make it big in the world of rock. He met vocalist Mark LaBelle and got into the band Ground Zero, and later formed the early incarnation of Dirty Honey, known then as the Shags, baby. John Notto got bassist Justin Smolian into the group, and Justin got drummer Corey Coverstone to be the fourth member. By March 2019, they released an EP on their own with five songs, one of which went to the number one position on mainstream rock radio. That song was When I'm Gone, and the follow-up, Rolling Sevens, went to number three. Things were looking great for the group. They opened for Slash, Guns N' Roses, The Who, and then the pandemic hit, and everything just kind of shut down, but not really for Dirty Honey. They continued to write original music with the goal of putting out a full LP, which they did on April 23rd, 2021. The group AC/DC wrote a song in 1975 called It's a Long Way to the Top If You Want to Rock and Roll, but it seems Dirty Honey found an express route. And with that, I welcome Dirty Honey's guitarist, John Notto. Hi there, John.
How's it going? That's a heck of an intro.
There you go. Well,
did you practice?
I aim to please. And bassist Justin Smolian. Hi there, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Doing wonderful. Both of you guys studied music in college, not the School of Rock with Jack Black, though. John, I'll start with you. So how did you get into playing guitar? Because the guitar sound you have on Dirty Honey's music sounds very familiar to guys my age and older. So how did you get into it?
I got into it by a friend's dad played in a punk rock band. My mother had a collection of vinyl records. Those two things combined created the retro monster that speaks to you now.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah. The first album that really spoke to me was Led Zeppelin II. Really, from the opening riff of Whole Lotta Love through to Heartbreaker and the whole album.
How old were you when you first heard the record?
I was like nine. That's kind of what started the obsession of old school music, you know?
So really, Mom, Dad, and Led Zeppelin.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Dad never grew out of like 50s and 60s music either. So that was always what he listened to and still does, and soul music. So he can actually dance.
Really? Oh, man, I'd love to see your dad dance.
I don't know if it's going to happen anymore, but and Mom can sing.
you kind of had a little showbiz going on in the family then.
Well, no, I wouldn't say showbiz, but just...
Well, I mean, performers. If your mom can sing, your dad can dance, and they were really into sort of punk and Led Zeppelin, and then they have you, and they're like, well, here's your heritage, son.
Well, it was a little bit like that. I think they were more, unfortunately, distracted with a blue-collar life. We weren't affluent. I think, actually, I kind of forget this, but the first guitar I got to hold was my dad's acoustic that he got it and wanted lessons, and he just didn't have time to do it. He was a truck driver, and he couldn't put his time into it. He actually accidentally left it outside, and it filled with water.
Whoops.
his commitment level was questionable.
Dude, that's what happened to my first acoustic guitar, too. Got left outside, ruined.
But once I showed interest, a guy who worked with him gave me his Aria Telecaster, which was pretty crappy. For a kid, it had pretty much unplayable action. But you could really air guitar to Led Zeppelin 2 to it.
So there absolutely.
Was, yeah. So there was that. I used to air guitar so hard I would rip the strap lugs out of it. It was a tough guitar. It was like 70s yellow. It was something else. But that was the beginning. And mom singing was more around the house. And she could correct me when I played things wrong. So she had a good ear and a good singing thing happened.
Nice. And Justin, you have an interesting background. Your first guitar teacher was in the 50s retro doo-wop group, Sha-na-na. There have been a ton of members cycling through Sha-na-na. I looked up on Wikipedia. I was all like, holy crap, they got a lot of people. So who was your teacher?
I mean, he just gave me my first guitar lesson, but his name was Danny McBride. No affiliation with the actor. He was the one that was in the band for Grease and when they had the TV show in the 70s. So I got a lot of good stories about rock and roll decadence from him. Because he definitely blew through millions of dollars having a good time.
Okay, so I'm pulled up the wiki on that. Dirty Dan is his nickname.
Yep, Dirty Dan.
and Dirty Dan earned that nickname.
So I only knew Sha-na-na from the TV show. That's all I knew. It's just sort of like this variety hour thing. I'm watching Bowser do his open mouth thing. And I've read this little bit. I'm all like, Sha-na-na's guitarist? And then I'm all like, how many guitarists did Sha-na-na have? Oh, they had a lot. There was a lot of people cycling in and out of this band. So
he was in the good part.
He was in the good part. So he taught you a little bit?
He kind of gave me my first guitar lesson when I was 10. And it was a pretty terrible guitar lesson. You know, he was trying to get me to do things that were just way too hard for my little hands. So I kind of played guitar for a little bit after that. And then my friend left my guitar out in the rain and it got destroyed. And then about a year later, all my friends were really into Nirvana and we all were starting to band. And my dad was like, oh, you should play bass because you'll always be working if you're a bass player. And that's kind of how I got into doing it.
You're kind of downplaying your credentials a little bit. You studied classical guitar in college.
That I did. I kind of fell into that. I played both guitar and bass all throughout junior high and high school. And then I got to college. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I took a classical guitar class because I wanted to get better at actually playing like the Led Zeppelin fingerstyle stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The head of the department was teaching the class and I was kind of better than most of the kids in the class. So he's like, hey, why don't you join the department? And I fell into that for a few years. I won some competitions, but I pretty much knew even when I started, like that wasn't my path in life. I was just, my parents were very into me going to college and getting some kind of degree. So I was like, oh, I might as well do music. But I was working like the whole time doing gigs in LA, like rock and roll gigs and pop gigs or whatever while doing that degree.
With your bass work, especially with Dirty Honey, and that's all I know, but it's so melodic and it's so busy. And when I read the little snippet that you studied
so busy.
Classical guitar,
so busy.
But it's really great, right? But I read that part and I was like, aha, he studied like classical guitar. That's why he's like all over the freaking guitar.
Yeah, I love Bach. I love counterpoint, especially Bach's music. You'll hear a lot of melodies being played in the bass. So I try to do that. And, you know, John and I, like, I think a lot of our favorite bands are two guitar bands like Aerosmith and the Stones. And they really have a guitar weaving thing going on. Even though we don't have a second guitar player, I try and fill some of that void of having counter melodies going to either John or Mark. That's kind of my approach to it.
And that was going to be my point when you guys keep referencing Led Zeppelin and the way that John Paul Jones and Jimmy Page work live compared to how they try to replicate their studio stuff. You guys, especially that film footage we saw, YouTube footage of you guys at the Troubadour a couple of years ago, you really hear that in songs like When I'm Gone, the live version of it. There goes Justin, you know, filling all those spaces. as Mark breaks into, or as you know, Mark's screaming and John breaks into the solo, I thought, God, that reminds me of like live Zeppelin, what they would do to try to recreate those songs where you had multiple guitar parts in the studio. I was going to ask you guys if that combo, that John Paul Jones, Jimmy Page combo, is something you guys think about when you create these songs live for the stage.
Yeah, I don't know if you think about it like, hey, let's do the thing, but I learned to play guitar from listening to live Jimmy Page. The song remains the same, the movie and the tapes or the CDs really grabbed me. And then How the West Was Won also, because as a kid, it just was like, these are so much more powerful in a way than the record, and I didn't know how that was possible. You know, of course, the audio sounds a little worse, but the power of the band is magnified by the way they're playing. And so I just cued in on how Jimmy Page somehow made you miss nothing with the way he played live. So I'm kind of doing that mixed with other influences. And I think Justin is doing the same thing. So it's kind of a kismet combination. It's unspoken.
I don't think I thought about it too much, but a little side note story. So during the pandemic, John and I and another friend, we went out to Joshua Tree with our girls. We took mushrooms, and I had actually a horrible time for part of it. I was throwing up the whole time. But then I remember coming out of the bathroom eventually, and John is like blasting like a live Zeppelin recording. I can't remember which one it was, but like I just remember hearing like the way John Paul Jones was playing, and like he was filling so much extra space that I was like, God, I got to like lean into that even more for our live show. So I think I've been trying to do that even a little bit more post-pandemic, if we could call this post-pandemic times.
I think I remember it. No, I'm just kidding.
You think you remember it?
You're not sure. You're not sure.
You may have just said it, and now I'm agreeing.
In the post-mushroom clarity that you are in now.
It's about an eight-hour window.
That's good, but maybe I caught you at a good time. So tell me a little bit about what, this is kind of a loaded question, but and both of you can answer it however you want to, but so what's the music scene like in LA? There's so much music being made now, and it's the second part of the question, but how did you guys get noticed by folks like your producer and manager, Nick Dadia, and Slash? How does this happen?
Nothing to do with the music scene here at all. We have a very unique connection story. I mean, Justin, as well as I, during our whole get it together, assemble the band, write songs phase of the Shags, Dirty Honey, Ground Zero, we were also working as sidemen. So we felt pretty connected. Like we know a lot. We still know a lot of musicians. Like we were watching the
Grammys a couple months ago. Yeah. We were on the road. Like every band, we were like, oh, we know that guitar player.
Yeah.
We know
that drummer. Oh, there's Tim. There's Dave. Yeah. We like literally. Mark simultaneously was making connections with Mark Dadia and guys at a major stage production facility, as well as guys at Live Nation. Mark Dadia is our manager, Nick Dadia's brother. And Mark Dadia, I mean, we could talk forever about his legacy. He's been around since the early 80s. He did all this playing hockey. Mark's a pretty good hockey player, to my understanding. I've never seen him play, but he...
Like ice hockey?
Ice hockey, yeah.
Okay.
Well, he grew up in upstate New York, and like hockey's been in his family, so like hockey was his whole thing. And we were always like, hockey, dude, whatever, we don't care. Like, so not into it. But, you know, it just ended up being, that was the stone that had the gem under it, a passion of his unrelated to music. I think because he was really good, he was able to work his way into leagues with really rich guys who want to have at least one person who's really good. Fast forward, you know, we're like the Shags or whatever, and we're playing our basement bar gig, which was our mainstay. It's called The Basement. He'd get like Cuba Gooding Jr. to come see us. One time he got...
Who licked my girlfriend's arm at one of the gigs.
Yeah. Total rager. Rager. Like he played with Jerry Bruckheimer. He played with like the head of marketing at Live Nation. All of those guys came to see us at one time or another.
So these are all hockey people?
They're all hockey people. It's crazy.
It is so crazy. Weird. I thought all the big deals were made on golf courses.
No, I know. It's crazy. And I think
it's all on the ice, baby.
Between dropping the puck and making deals.
It took a long time, I think, for Mark Dadia to take Mark LaBelle seriously, because I think he just saw him as a cool kid who was like a jock kind of guy who had a cover band. So he didn't really care about us. The side hustle was, how do we get Mark Didier to take us seriously? Kind of the whole time. You know, and there were a few swing and a misses. And before Justin was in the band, early on, he did come to see us open for Steel Panther. And he still maintains to this day that we only played covers, but we only played a 30-minute set of Mark's old originals. But he's like, no, you were just a cover band. I'm like, yeah, I know, but that set, okay, never mind.
Maybe Mark was on mushrooms. You know, it's possible.
I mean, I think, yeah. He definitely had his time. I took up a lot of that answer, but it wasn't made on the Sunset Strip or working the scene or mm-hmm. getting noticed. Even though we were playing live gigs, it didn't happen that way. We didn't play the Viper Room maybe once, and we didn't play the Strip. We didn't play the Silver Lake Hang.
Yeah, Sunset Strip, by the way, not cool growing up. I grew up in LA. Not cool, not a scene.
Yeah, you're from Van Nuys, right?
Yeah. And I mean, I used to go to shows on the Sunset Strip, but it's not like everybody romanticizes it. It's not like it was in the 80s. There's not like kids running around the streets just tamming all the time. You know, it's kind of all like a lot of the same people that have been there since the 80s. And it is kind of depressing a lot of the time.
Mick Mars is sitting at the Rainbow ordering a Diet Coke. Like, hey, I'm still here. Dude, what up?
Honestly, like growing up, I'd go to the Rainbow sometimes, and Lemmy was always there playing video poker at the end of the bar, just like getting hammered and not talking to anybody, just fucking playing video poker.
You wish it was Mick Mars, but in reality, it's Ron Jeremy asking if he can play harmonica.
Ron Jeremy also hit on my girlfriend.
Yeah, of course.
Your girlfriend's got a lot of stories. My arm was licked by a Cuba Gooding Jr. Ron Jeremy tried to pick up on me.
I need a shower.
Hey, quick Ron Jeremy story involving Justin and his birthday. One year we went to...
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? So, do you want to tell it? Or
we can do it together.
Okay. So I'll preface. We went to this thing called... It was actually called Porn Star Karaoke. It was a karaoke bar. On Tuesdays, it was... Like
In Burbank.
It's actually gone now, but the whole place, but it was called Porn Star Karaoke. And of course, Ron Jeremy walked in. But the highlight was this young porn actress trying
to. This is at the end of the night when we're all leaving the bar, walking to our cars, by the way.
So she's trying to get a gig with Ron Jeremy. And in front of everybody, she's like, where's your car? Right now. Take me your car. Just let me go to. Can I say whatever
just
I want?
Let me blow you. begging him to blow him.
And he was
to
like,
show him how good she was.
And she's like, no, go away. He's like, nah.
You guys got some LA stories, don't you?
Oh, yeah, dude. Oh, yeah.
It doesn't happen that way up north of Sacramento. So it's fun to hear what's happening down there.
He was literally, he couldn't care less. He could, it was amazing.
It's a job for him, right? I mean, this is like,
literally,
it's like every director getting a, you know, resume and a headshot from an aspiring actor or a screenwriter saying, will you read my screenplay? Yeah. We're trying to figure out, John and I, we're trying to figure out how old are you guys? Because we're looking at your picture on the back. We're like, yeah, you know, a couple of them have facial hair. They got the long hair. They got glasses, you know, dark glasses on. I don't know. And I pegged it like, they got to be in their mid-20s, somewhere in there. So what are your ages? Just curious.
I like to call myself timeless.
Don't we all?
We're a little older than that. But, okay. You know, we like to keep it a mystery. It's more fun that way.
All right. We interviewed this other band that we thought they're called Unscripted. They're actually from Sri Lanka. They're really great.
Sri Lanka.
They're from Sri Lanka. Yeah. They're a funk soul band. That's just amazing song they have called Hourglass, if you ever get a chance to check them out. But I'm looking at their video and I'm like, how old are you guys? Were you like 22, 23? Because, you know, John and I were in our mid 50s and we're like, everyone looks young to us. So they started laughing and they're like, some of us are, you know, in their 30s. Some of us are in our late 20s. I was like, okay. So we're trying to figure out, are the members of Dirty Honey the same age as our kids? That's what we were trying to figure out.
Yeah. We're probably a little, how old are your kids? Yeah.
My daughter's 25.
We're a little older than that, but
okay.
It seems overnight, but we had to cut our teeth in LA for a while, you know.
Okay. All right. When I was looking at the timeline based on the articles that had spotlighted the band, and then, you know, John Notto, you were basically the spokesperson. You were talking about how your timeline of coming to Los Angeles, I thought, wow, you guys got going pretty quickly and things happened. Things kind of clicked, but it seems like you were doing a lot when you got to LA and maybe a little bit before that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. It's just we hit the ground running and as individuals. Once we made a demo at a professional studio with Corey, every couple months, something exciting happened.
So let's talk a little bit about the current record, which John and I absolutely love. It's a relatively short album, especially in this day and age when people are noted for filling up that CD for 70 minutes of music or whatever. It's 8 songs, clocks in at about 30 minutes. How much did you guys work on these songs before you felt like you were ready to go into a studio and record them? Because I know you're coming off the EP, which had done really well for you. So was this like right away you went and started working on new songs, or did you have some of these written when you put out the EP?
I don't think any were written when we put out the EP. The EP was kind of everything that we could scrape together at the time. Like a couple of those songs got finished in Australia on the EP. But the LP, we had a couple songs that we wrote on those first couple tours that we did. And we were actually getting ready to go back to Australia. That's where our producer, Nick Dadia, lives. And like 2 days before we got on the, we were supposed to get on the flight is when lockdown happened. And obviously we still can't even get over there. So we spent the next couple of months, we rented out a lockout and just, we only had enough material. We were probably only going to make an EP again. So we workshopped all the songs that we already had and then worked on a few new ones. And we actually ended up recording 11 songs during the sessions, but only ended up releasing 8 because we felt like those 8 really went well together. And maybe this the other 3 could have been done a little bit better. So you might hear those on the next one, or maybe we'll scrap them. Who cares?
Yeah. I always like to be like, what's the next song? What's the next song? Almost to a fault, because I've learned that if there's even like 2 bars of something great, you shouldn't forget about it.
Yeah.
As I'm listening to you guys describe the process a little bit, my coworker Ted here has a saying. He likes to talk about palate cleansing in the music business. Like after we've had a lot of one type of sound, a band comes along and cleanses our palates a little bit, like throws something new at the wall we haven't heard, or maybe it's a retro sound we've heard in a while, but it's time for a change. When you guys look at yourself across the sort of emerging musical landscape now, do you guys see yourself as sort of a new thing, or as a nod to a sound from the past? How do you guys slot yourself into new hard rock music? Obviously, you've got a lot of us 50-somethings freaking out over how much we love Les Pauls and Marshall Stacks and the kind of live energy you have. Do you see that as new to people? Are 20-somethings going, well, this is bluesy and it's not got a lot of keyboards and I like it? How do you guys see yourself in the pantheon of rock music right now? Sorry for using the word pantheon, by the way.
No, it's cool. And I could always speak to myself personally, but my goal was always to kind of carry the torch in a new way, to take what our favorite bands like Guns N' Roses or Aerosmith or the Stones, like that kind of style of music. And I don't want to say reinvent it, but like be the next phase of it. We're not copying it, but we're taking our influences of that style of music and the next progression of it. That's always been my goal. I don't know how John sees himself.
It's fucking amazing. And that's a quote from Mark Bell, but I would say the same after watching your troubadour shreddiness. Is that a word? Shreddiness?
Sure.
I just, as a Les Paul fanatic myself, just looking at that, whoever filmed it, you know, looking at your Marshall cabinet facing backwards against the wall and all of a sudden Mark off stage and
see, you start it's cool, playing. John.
Yeah. It was super, as I'm watching you shred that particular troubadour solo and watching the different phases you went into, like single note bends, now you're shredding like Kirk Hammett. I'm thinking, is your influence as big as maybe I think it is? Like, you're not just a Jimmy Page disciple. I love a little Hendrix. Do you love all the shred-tastic guys from the 80s and 90s too? Is that part of your toolbox when you get up there and do a solo like that?
It's more just singularly Eddie in terms of shred guys. Sometimes I could listen to like Ozzy No More Tears album and be like, wow, Zakk Wylde's a beast. I mean, he is a beast, obviously. He isn't like a constant resonation with like his style of playing. But Eddie definitely, I love him so much. And he's like, I've looked into it way too much, but he's literally the crossover, because his language and the way he shoots from the hip and also fills the gaps between a vocalist is still very blues man, but his techniques and his tone are the future of shred. So I love it because it's still rock and roll. So I think it like fits with my Jimmy Page influence, but I love Brian May too. And over the years I've realized that Brian May is actually kind of shreddy, even though he doesn't play fast. He doesn't play hard and bluesy like Slash or something, you know? And also Slash shreds, you know? So a lot of my heroes get into that kind of frantic thing. But I'm definitely a mishmash. And I think for a while, I wasn't sure if that worked, but now I'm realizing it's part of the sound. And a lot of people have complimented on the band in general that we sound like a bunch of things, not one thing.
Yeah, and John always downplays this, but he's actually like a killing R&B funk guitar player too, which I think allows me to kind of play more crazy lines on the bass, because he'll pull away and play really strong rhythm, which allows me to be a little bit more free in the way that I play also.
I definitely noticed that on the single, the first single, California Dreamin', from the new album, especially right at the pre-chorus. You're just like, you're off. It's like, listen to this guy. I wish it was a little higher in the mix sometimes.
I think the funk guitar thing fits over into that concept of, you know, in funk guitar, a lot of times we compare it to like the role is like a tambourine. But in a trio like this, that concept also works with repeating the riff and kind of holding it down. That allows Justin to move around. It gives it kind of a different dynamic.
And speaking of dynamics, now what rounds out, of course, you've got a great drummer in Corey Coverstone, but your lead vocalist, Mark LaBelle. I follow you guys, or at least Planet LP, which is John and myself. We follow you on Instagram. And on there is a video of Mark LaBelle in the Italian Dolomite Mountains singing a bit of the song The Wire. Let me play a snippet of that. It's only like 30 seconds long, so people can hear it.
And all this time should have realized I've been walking your wire. And I've been walking your wire, paying for too long. Been walking your wire. It won't take too long till I turn and walk away.
Damn. Nice set of pipes, man.
It's real. He's real.
It's real. Yeah. I also noticed there's a little bit of that Mountain Supply reverb echo that helps with his voice. But
definitely helps, yep.
Holy crap, man. I mean, in order to hit those notes on a tour night after night, you've really got to preserve your voice. So how does he keep that voice in good shape on the road?
He's pretty diligent about warming up before shows. He's got this little exercise routine. It sounds pretty funny. It's like,
you know, but it works, right?
It works. Yeah, he's over there diddling his tongue and stuff, but yeah,
he takes care of his body too. He eats pretty well. He doesn't smoke. He exercises. He takes care of his instrument.
He's in it for the long haul. You can tell, because in order to bring that kind of vocal performance night after night, that's like a marathon. You really got to train for that.
It's kind of funny. It's never seemed difficult for him, because we used to do these 3-hour cover gigs and his voice never gave out. And I mean, he was singing Zeppelin and Aerosmith all night. So like doing these hour shows, it doesn't.
It's not really a big deal in a way. Yeah.
It's not really a big deal for him. Yeah.
We should all be so lucky, right?
Yeah. I mean, literally, like we went from being unnoticed and playing 3.5-hour gigs from 10 to 2 to like, yeah, traveling and not sleeping well and being uncomfortable, but only playing 30-minute sets. You don't even warm up at that point. Seriously.
You're saying goodnight. You're saying I'm ready to play some more at this point, right?
Good night, Cleveland. We've just now gotten. By the end of that first year, which was a whirlwind, we worked our way up to 75-minute sets. That's where we were even a little longer on this last headlining run we did.
Right. And what I want to do is tease it a little bit and saying that we're going to actually talk to John and Justin via Zoom, which will be on our social channels, in which they have an announcement that they're going to be hitting the road with a very noted band. So we're going to kind of tease it so you can kind of come on over to the social channels and check that out. And with that, John Otto, Justin Smolian, I want to thank you for making time to be on the Planet LP podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
And that's our show for another week. John Young, that is. Thanks as always for taking this podcast journey with me, my friend.
It is always a pleasure, and extra sticky today, my friend.
Definitely, yeah. Got some dirty honey all over me. How about you, John?
Yeah.
And thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will be back very soon.